Blog Talk Radio.
Well, the ongoing conversation about the bombing in Syria is filling up the airwaves, of course, and there are fans and critics on both sides. Some Donald Trump voters claim that they're very disillusioned with him, and they didn't think that they were signing up for this type of thing. On the other hand, a lot of people, including former Obama staffers, even were jumping up and clapping their hands and letting people know that they were glad that something had finally happened to Assad. So we'll keep you posted on that. In the meantime, a little bit of news, some headlines. Russia is threatening to strike back at Trump. ISIS bombing in Egypt kills 47. Palm Sunday horror. They came to pray and died. Dead rotting bat found in Walmart salad. That could be an extra special element for people who love, the rainforests. Rabbi setting out to build first Jewish campus in Berlin since Holocaust. Le Pen says France not responsible for a World War II Jewish roundup. Supply of homes for sale has not been this thin in nearly 20 years. The economy is starting to cook a little bit faster. U.S. sending out its military hardware into the Korean Peninsula area. Crisis deepening with North Korea. In Georgia, a Democrat candidate is threatening to make Trump furious, which has got people unnerved. Gorsuch into the Supreme Court, and he immediately has cases. Private property owners could be the biggest block to Donald Trump's plan to build the wall. Wisconsin, first state to stop dictating how much time kids should go to school. And what's a bigger waste of time for a lot of kids than going to school in terms of specific teaching that they need? I know this is going to sound shocking, but let me put it to you this way. How much time did you waste in school? And if you were at home getting trained or in a more specific environment, how much more could you have learned? Let's put it that way. Because this one-size-fits-all schooling style doesn't seem to always work out the best way. All right, so I've got a little bit from Krauthammer on the Syria implications, sending all those bombs in. You can criticize Trump, but you have to admit there was some part of you when you heard about the missiles being sent in that said to yourself, it's about time, right? I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous what Barack Obama did when all of these warnings were put out there and the military got ready, and then we didn't attack, and then it was just, you know, after that it was, you didn't have to worry about what what America thought anymore. It was very sad. So waiting on that clip for a minute. I've got something that I kind of dug up. I found this story that talked about the separation of England from the European continent. And so I went around and dug around and listened to a bunch of clips on the possibility of an ancient flood. There's a lot of information out there. I thought you might find interesting as kind of a segue. Here is the clip with Charles Krauthammer's commentary on the Syrian strike.
Opinion editor for the Washington Times and syndicated columnist Charles Krauthammer. Okay, Tom, thoughts?
Yeah, I think it was absolutely the right thing to do. President Trump didn't just act, he acted quickly. And in doing that, I think as Senator McConnell notes, he absolutely has put himself in a position of strength going forwards, whatever he decides to do next. Sunni Arab monarchies, extremely happy, relieved. That helps in terms of reducing their impetus to fund groups like Al-Qaeda as a counterbalance to Iran. But on this specific issue of the rule of law in the world, the American anchor point will sustain. I think Trump took a major step forward there. And if you look at the respective elation in governments across Europe at what has been done, I think it is the proof that this desire for American leadership was desperately desired.
As we put up Sean Spicer's tweet after you're looking at this Tomahawk cruise missile, Sean Spicer's tweet of the room where President Trump was, the image after the strike apparently was ordered at 9:15 p.m. Eastern time. Charles, the world reaction seemed like, again, it was respectful of the strength move.
I think it was extremely important for precisely that reason. It'll have its particular effects on the ground in Syria. It's a warning to Assad and the Russians and the Iranians. You no longer have a free hand. You're going to pay a price. Next time, it'll be a bigger price. But I think the most important element here is that the world had looked at this area and seen the profound abdication for 8 years, where the United States had disappeared, and also the beginning of the Trump administration with a man who came into office, in fact, who said only a week ago, I'm not president of the world, I'm president of the United States. We'd have to look after our own interests here at home, who gave an inaugural address in which he essentially said, we are not interested in policing the world. And then this is a sort of neck snapping about face, which is extremely salutary. All of a sudden, as Tom said, the United States reacts, and quickly, unlike Obama, where you'd have weeks of public hand-wringing. Remember when he came up with the policy on Afghanistan? It took something like 8 months. This is about 48 hours and America strikes. So I think that's the most important message, particularly important for the Chinese, for the Koreans, for the Russians. America is back and it is liable to react now. You no longer have a free hand. And that, I think, is going to change a lot in the world from a single response like this.
We should note about that Russian ship in the Mediterranean. Russian ships are in the Mediterranean from time to time. This one moved in just today, where the other two U.S. naval vessels that fired the Tomahawk missiles, not insinuating that they're making an aggressive move, but it was moved there today. Here is the U.N. Ambassador to the U.S., Nikki Haley, and the Russian ambassador.
It could be that Russia is knowingly allowing chemical weapons to remain in Syria. It could be that Russia has been incompetent in its efforts to remove the chemical weapons. Or it could be that the Assad regime is playing the Russians for fools.
We will
recall that General...
Anyway, strong pushback and follow-up at the United Nations. So... That is the kind of response that area has been dying for. Now, whether it fits in with your brand of conservatism, 523-1450, feel free to call in. or as Frankie likes to do, lay home in bed and suck on your baby bottle full of Jack Daniels and yell at MSNBC TV and occasionally text to the show here. But I think it resets the table. It resets the conversation. It's probably a shock to everybody who was out there that America was never going to stand up again. Now, there was some, and I have to kind of dig around for it, but I ran into a clip last night of the basically what the conversation was is that we're dealing with a group of people, and I'm talking about Americans who are so completely spoiled or misinformed during the time with Obama that they've picked up a kind of pacifism. Pacifism now not only seems right, but it seems like the only way to go. And you've got a lot of stuff going on out there where the only, you know, it's like the schoolyard bully. I mean, it's the obvious example is that you've got to stand up when someone threatens you or attacks you, you've got to stand up, or you have to, on the alternative, absorb the consequences of not standing up. And not standing up is ultimately a lot more costly and scary than fighting back. So now, this wasn't a direct attack against us, but it was the use of mustard gas, in which is against world law, but Assad didn't have to pay any price for it. So anyway, we'll take a little break here, a little Pat Metheny this week. 523-1450-805-6182-802 text. And I'm going to gradually work my way towards this idea that there may have been an ancient flood. There's an enormous amount of evidence. The question, though, is was it just during a time of geological unrest, or was it something more along the lines of what these ancient books talk about, or possibly both? 6:18 on the button, and be right back. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces. Well, Trump may have some converts. I'm sure he's lost some support from radical or at least garden variety pacifists. But there are five celebrities or commentators who have supported his serious strike. Brian Williams, who called the missiles beautiful, absolutely gorgeous. Fareed Zakaria is also backing the Donald on this one. Here's Brian Williams, though, who has cautioned Trump against telling fibs. Here he is.
Go into greater detail. We see these beautiful pictures at night from the decks of these two U.S. Navy vessels in the Eastern Mediterranean. I am tempted to quote the great Leonard Cohen, "I'm guided by the beauty of our weapons." And they are beautiful pictures of fearsome armaments making what is for them a brief flight over to this airfield. What did they hit? What are you convinced?
Wow, almost sounds like the Star Spangled Banner. Zakaria, a critic. Jedediah Beelot is a female on The View. I thought that was a guy's name from the Bible. For Scarborough and Mika the Dunce Brzezinski are also backing the president. All right, so there is, I figure you probably want just a little bit of an update on what's going on with this lady, Susan Rice. I think she's crisped, but check this out.
The revelation that Susan Rice sought to and succeeded in unmasking the identities of the Trump administration transition officials whose phone calls were monitored while they spoke to foreigners is, I think, a very important one, which unfortunately the liberal mainstream media has totally ignored. New York Times didn't even cover it, and two of the three networks didn't mention it, and the third defended Susan Rice as they were mentioning it. Let's understand what really happened here. When Obama left office and Hillary lost the election in a stunning surprise, the liberals and the Democrats decided to adopt a strategy of blame Russia, a blame that the Russians hacked the U.S. election, that they sent out disinformation, that they unearthed the emails of the Democratic National Committee and John Podesta, the chief of staff, and that this whole election was influenced by Putin, who wanted Trump to get elected. And to substantiate that point of view, the Obama administration needed to find out who the Russians were in touch with on the Trump transition team. Now, that eavesdropping, that surveillance, is normal. The FBI is supposed to surveil Russian agents and other foreigners who are involved in potentially influencing the U.S. policy. And in the course of doing it, they picked up several communications between those folks and members of the Trump transition team. But as the law requires, when you incidentally pick up a transmission that involves an American citizen, you cannot identify him. You have to say citizen one, citizen two, citizen three. Well, Rice penetrated that and said, okay, I want to know who those citizens are, and then kept a list of them and traced through what calls they had been involved in. And that formed the basis of the Trump, of the Obama administration claim in its closing days that Trump's incoming people were in cahoots with the Russians. And in particular, Michael Flynn, the incoming national security advisor, was accused of having a phone call with the Russian ambassador. And the supposition was that they might have discussed weakening the sanctions on Russia that Obama had just imposed, and that Flynn might have told the Russians that when he took over, he would loosen those sanctions. Well, first of all, there's nothing wrong with it if he did that. It's perfectly legitimate for an incoming official to signal a foreign power what he's planning to do within the 4 or 5 weeks remaining when he takes office. But this fueled the entire narrative, the idea that she discovered these contacts and these communications. Now, let's understand how totally phony this scandal is. Everybody agrees that the Russians did not try to alter the vote totals when the votes were counted. Everybody agrees that that Trump himself, that there is no evidence that he was involved in any way with what the Russians were doing. If Russia indeed outed the emails from the Democratic National Committee and from John Podesta in an effort to influence the election, what of it? I'm glad they did. And it's important that we learn the truth as the American people about what our politicians are doing, despite their efforts to hide them. But this entire thing fueled this whole national security scandal. And the revelation of these names permitted leaking that destroyed them or went after them. You know, the normal Washington punishment for being leaked on is the death penalty. You're forced out of office like Flynn was. And Susan Rice has now been unmasked in this. And it's important for us to realize that all of these leaks, all of the stuff coming out of the old Obama administration, and now the stuff coming out of the bureaucracy criticizing Trump, are in fact largely from Obama holdovers who are doing this to embarrass the Trump administration. Jobs report that indicates that the economy.
All right, so he goes on to a jobs report where he says the growth area in medicine for jobs is actually a very good sign because of the fact that it points out how medical industry and healthcare is putting faith back in Trump or putting faith back into the Oval Office. Now, Here's a little more on Susan Rice's unmasking from a former FBI agent.
One of the things that struck me, and I think it's been lost in the sauce on Ms. Rice's comments, is that these leaks were not done for political purposes. That didn't mean that she said they still weren't done. So that's a broad area to cover to say I wasn't doing this for any sort of political agenda here, but they were still done. And that leaves a wide room to, I guess, avoid a legal action against yourself. But, I mean, what do you make of that?
So, Neil, I'm going to give you three words, and you're probably going to hear these three words over and over again as this investigation continues. Foreign intelligence purpose. That's the legal standard for which you can unmask or reveal the identity of a U.S. person that's caught up by accident, or not accident, incidentally, when monitoring another target. If there's a legitimate foreign intelligence purpose, it's legal. If there isn't, it's not.
All right, but what if you are making the argument, I'm no lawyer and you know the ins and outs of this far better than I, that you thought at the time there was. Is that enough cover for you, or enough cover to say, no, but this was, I never had any political ends or goals here?
Well, I think we need to be clear about how this takes place. So the National Security Advisor can't just unmask this person by herself or himself. It's not a button you push. This is a request that's made to the intelligence agency that did the collection, and you have to provide the justification for the request. Then there are officials who review that request and decide whether it meets the standard, and they have to document all of this.
Well, I mean, the obvious observation is that she was able to state to these FBI people that there was a concern that the Trump campaign was interacting with the Russian government in such a way that it was illegal. But that, in my opinion, doesn't get her off the hook. 6:31, Kelly O'Connell, we've got some local news, 523-1450 to call in, and 805-61802 text. We'll be right back. All right, a little bit of news over sanctuary cities and immigration. First off, the Rio Grande Valley is unusually quiet, according to the LA Times. Border crossings, the lowest in at least 17 years. It's been decades since there have been less crossings. And so that is something you have to attribute to Trump, obviously. Across the southwest border, the number of immigrants caught crossing illegally into the United States has dropped dramatically. Fewer than 12,200 people were apprehended in March, a 64% decrease from the same time last year, the lowest number in 17 years at least. In the Rio Grande Valley, to be and probably still is the number one place to cross, the number of families and unaccompanied children caught entering the U.S. has plummeted from around 300 a day in January to just 37 a day in March. So it's dropped almost 90%, maybe 80%, 85%. And so agents was asked about it and said, are you going to risk a 1,000-mile journey and pay $8,000 to be smuggled if you're not sure you'll get to stay in your new country? And, of course, the answer to that is no. Smugglers are taking in from between 7,000 to 11,000 on routes that are called increasingly perilous. And the sales pitch is, if you want to get to America, you better come now, because once the fence goes up, you're not going to have a chance. So 3,000 Border Patrol agents monitor the Rio Grande Valley's 315-mile-long border. And so anyway, for those people who wanted to see a decrease in illegal immigration, there you have it. There is a battle over how sanctuary cities are going to be treated. And is from thehill.com.
Four Republican representatives announced
here,
their plan to deny.
Text me. Mm-hmm.
Hold on just a second here. But having to do with same topic, sanctuary cities.
Four Republican representatives announced their plan to deny general federal funds from American cities that harbor illegal aliens and frustrate federal efforts to enforce immigration laws. The move follows Attorney General Jeff Sessions announcing his own plans to crack down on so-called sanctuary cities by withholding Justice Department grants that they are entitled to. Sessions also hinted last week that he would look into additional methods of being detrimental to these jurisdictions, which include some of the nation's largest cities, such as New York City and Chicago.
So 33 states have introduced measures to limit or prevent cities from acting as sanctuary cities. Virginia recently made it illegal to be a sanctuary city inside the state. And right, I heard driving into the show this morning, Tennessee is trying to make those who are illegal not have to pay out-of-state tuition, which seems absolutely ridiculous. But in Texas, Governor Greg Abbott has withheld millions of dollars in grants to Austin's Travis County alone. And obviously, the only way to get the attention of a lot of these folks is through withholding money. And I don't know what else to. I mean, that's, I guess the same thing is going to have to happen here. So. We'll take a little segue here and pick up some local weather. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450, and 805-6180 to text. And I've got a little bit on floods, ancient floods. All right, so I was looking at some stories last night, and I saw a story in Real Clear Life, part of Real Clear Politics. There's a lot of sections in there in Real Clear Politics. They have a section on science, another one on medicine, another one on history, et cetera, et cetera. So looked into this one. The first Brexit happened thousands of years ago, new research shows, and I had run into this story a while back. Hundreds of thousands of years ago, Britain was part of the same landmass as the rest of Europe. And new research shows two major erosion events called the Dover Strait, which now divides England and France at their closest points. This erosion event, this flood forward now, there's a couple of different theories on it, but one of which is that when the Ice Age ended, there was flooding. So anyway, I started to think about, wait, how much evidence is there for ancient flooding? Because a lot of people, obviously, number one, believe in a flood of the Bible. But here's the thing, whether you're into that type of thing or not, there is or there are flood myths in hundreds, if not thousands, of ancient societies, of the history in their myths, which is kind of eye-opening. But on top of that, and many of them sound similar, on top of that, there is actual evidence of massive flooding in the ancient world. And so I thought I would spend a little time today on this. And the first one that I have for you is from ABC News. which kind of lays a, I guess, kind of the out of foundation of the idea that it is not this idea of the ancient flood or ancient floods is not only not rejected by science, but some of the greatest scientists in oceanographic scientists believe that it did occur. And this is from ABC with Christine Amanpour.
Christian Amanpour in a two-part special beginning tonight on ABC. Christian goes back to the Holy Land to take us inside the history and mysteries of the Bible. And Christian, you met with one scientist who says there's actually proof that the great flood that took away Noah's Ark existed?
Well, as you can imagine, historians, archaeologists, discoverers are always trying to figure out, were these stories true? What aspects of them were? Now, nobody really believes they'll ever find an ark. I mean, for obvious reasons, wood, decay, etc. But Robert Ballard, who found the Titanic shipwreck in 1985, believes that there is evidence of a massive flood about 7,000 years ago, which is when the Bible situates Noah's story, and he thinks it's in the Black Sea region of Turkey. Let's take a listen.
Our journey to investigate the story of Noah and his ark led us to the banks of the Black Sea in Turkey, where we heard that tantalizing clues were being uncovered by Dr. Robert Ballard, one of the world's leading underwater archaeologists.
All right, let's get closer down.
We were astonished to learn that he believes the biblical flood could have actually happened. And he says he can find proof.
If you were to discover definitively something that could pin science on the Noah story, how fantastic would that be?
Well, it would be pretty cool. And I'm confident we can. We just have to look.
Now, using advanced robotic technology, he's traveling even further back in time.
I'm putting a lot of money in the water, and obviously can't wait to see what it's going to see. We talk about the floods of our living history. Boy, they don't compare at all to the floods of ancient times. The question is, was there a mother of all floods?
Ballard thinks there was, and he's testing a controversial theory that the biblical flood happened here.
Why the Black Sea? Well, because the Black Sea appears to have had a giant flood, not just a slow-moving, advancing rise of sea level, but a really big flood, and people were living there.
The theory goes this was once an isolated freshwater lake, but then when the Mediterranean swelled,
at some magic moment, it broke through and flooded this place violently.
What did Noah or the people who lived there during what you believe to be this huge flood, what did they see?
It probably was a bad day, and a lot of real estate, 150,000 square kilometers of land, went under.
And 400 feet below the surface, Ballard believes he's found proof of that catastrophic event.
I love it. I love it. I love it.
They unearthed an ancient shoreline.
Well, we actually dated it about 5,000 BC.
And that is about the time that the Bible says
exactly.
Noah and the great flood happened. I mean, wow.
Wow. So it nailed it.
Wow, Christian, what an adventure this must have been.
It really was an adventure. We trace Moses' steps up Mount Sinai. We trace Abraham's path. And, you know, it's really actually a very healing message because...
All right, so healing message or not, here is a little bit more on... Some stuff is actually pretty interesting. Here's just a couple of minutes on the great flood myth in myth and cult. For some reason, there is a flood myth in all these ancient societies, and the question is why? Check this out.
One of the greatest stories ever told is that of the worldwide flood. Most cultures in antiquity have a flood myth. In India, a little fish swims up to the wise sage Manu and warns him of a great flood. Manu builds a ship, and the fish grows in size and carries the boat through the waters. Amongst the Norse, it is the mighty frost giant Bergelmir who survives a deluge of blood pouring from wounds of the cosmic Ymir, whose body forms the world. Similarly in Egypt, as the reign of Ra comes to an end, the human race is drowned out by the wrathful blood of Sekhmet. Perhaps a tenuous connection, complicated by the introduction of a great flood in chapter 175 of the Egyptian Book of the Dead. In Greek myth, it is Deucalion, son of Prometheus, who survives a worldwide flood in an ark and repeoples the world by throwing stones behind his shoulder. From East Asia, Micronesia, Australia, North and South America, Europe and India, flood stories prevail throughout oral cultures. Why is the Great Flood a universal story? Did the story originate in far-off times and migrate to the Americas before the melting of the last ice age? If so, then the flood myth is exceedingly ancient. Did the story migrate across the seas from Asia to the Americas? Dispersion theory has always been a hot-button issue, especially for American scholars. Or did the flood story independently originate around the globe? No one can say for sure.
All right, so let's take our last break here, and I've got one more little clip for you. Kelly O'Connelly in Las Cruces, 523-1450 and 805-61-802 text. You're listening to KOBE Radio Las Cruces. Be right back. In case you are curious, here's a couple of particular myths, one from the ancient Chinese, just in case you're interested in what they sounded like.
A great flood at the dawn of Chinese civilization was said to have swept away settlements, the water rising so high that it overran hills, mountains, and even heaven itself. It was the sage King Yu who tamed the waters by building ditches, the legend went, thus earning a mandate to rule and laying the foundation for China's first dynasty, the Xia. But until now, scientists could not pin down evidence that the flood, or Yu, or even the Xia dynasty ever existed outside of the origin myths passed down through millennia. Now, a team of researchers led by Wu Kuaiyang, a former Peking University seismologist, said in a study published this week in the Journal of Science that they've indeed found evidence that a flood submerged a vast swath of the country almost 4,000 years ago, possibly lending weight to a long-standing, though controversial, theory that the Xia dynasty did exist as China's first unified state. Using radiocarbon dating of bones and soil samples along the Yellow River, Wu's team established that an earthquake triggered a huge landslide, damming the waterway in 1920 BC. The researchers pinpointed the date chemically from the skeletons of children in a group of 14 victims found crushed downstream, apparently when their home collapsed in the earthquake. The researchers deduced that for 6 to 9 months, about 15 trillion liters, or 4 trillion gallons, of water built up behind a wall of rock and dirt, about half the size of Lake Mead behind Hoover Dam, near Jijish Gorge in today's Qinghai Province. When the dam broke, it tore through the gorge at 500 times the Yellow River's average discharge and submerged the North China Plain that is considered the cradle of Chinese civilization. The flood on Asia's third longest river would have been among the worst anywhere in the world in the last 10,000 years and matches the tale of the Great Flood that marks the start of Chinese civilization with the Xia dynasty.
That information's about a year old. All right, here's from the myth of the Aztecs.
The Ancient One became unhappy with mankind for not honoring him, so he decided to destroy all of them. At the last minute, he decided to save one man, along with his wife and children, because they were such hard workers. So the Ancient One went to the family and said, "You need to stop working in the maize field and do what I tell you, because I'm going to destroy all the people in the world except for you." Then he told them to find the biggest cedar tree in the forest, cut it down, and hollow out a huge canoe. Then to fill the canoe with food and water, for soon the Ancient One would make it rain harder than it had ever rained before, and the family needed a boat, or they would surely drown. In a few days, after much hard work, the canoe was ready. That night, the family crawled into the boat and pulled mats over the top to keep the rain out. At dusk, the rain started, and just before dawn, the man felt the canoe lurch. He looked out from under the mats and saw that the boat had broken loose from the ground and was floating. All day, the family watched the water rise, and by nightfall, their craft was floating among the branches of the highest trees. They ate some food and went to sleep. When they awoke the next morning, there was nothing but water as far as the eye could see. They floated for days, and before long, they had eaten all their food and drunk all their water. When they were near starvation, however, the Ancient One remembered them and ordered the water to go down. The waters of the earth went back to their natural streams, lakes, and oceans. But many of the world's fish did not make it, and the ground was covered in dead fish. The man picked up some fish and ate them.
All right, so that's the Aztec. Interesting, though, a lot of these myths have the same basic outline, one family saved, that type of thing. We'll take a break on the hour, and we'll come back and dig in more to proof of any ancient flooding. 523-1450-805-6180. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450 on KOBE. Well, good morning. If you're just joining us, I've been talking about a little bit about Susan Rice, of course, a little bit on the Syrian missile attack that we launched. But I found a story yesterday about the creation of the island of England, if you want to put it that way, the British Isles, and how at one time England was part of continental Europe and then a flood came. So it reminded me of some of the stories that I had heard over the years of ancient floods and ancient flood myths, which is a separate issue, but is kind of interesting. So the fact of the matter is that there's a lot of evidence out there for ancient flooding now. Let me get into some headlines here. Syrian war, the G7 nations, the leading nations of the world getting together to talk about what to do about Syria. And I think Donald Trump, his attack helps to motivate people to do something about it, including Assad. Neil Gorsuch getting confirmed as we speak, as we hang out on the radio. And looking, Aaron Rodgers breaks up with his girlfriend, Olivia Munn, and maybe he'll get back with his family. So the, let's see here. Now this is a good day to do a little kind of a side story. I'll have to bring it in tomorrow. There was a planet that they were studying whose atmosphere was five times as electric as ours. And they were discussing how that would affect life. You know, there's a lot of research and writing that's done on the idea of relocating to other planets. And I find it very entertaining because I'm virtually any planet that we would move to would be thousands of times more inhospitable than the Earth. But supposedly, because of the selfishness and the greediness of mankind, especially conservatives, the planet is getting destroyed. Therefore, we have to find a new home, even if it means living in balloons above the clouds. Is it Venus? I think that's the one that has the... Let's see if I can find that here. There's one of these places where we would be living in balloons above the clouds that are... I don't even understand how you could encourage the idea that you need to go to another planet to live when just taking one step outside would immediately kill you. Let me see what I can find here to find it on a break. Let me look for this thing. In the meantime, a little bit more on... All right, so this is a good backdrop on this prehistoric megastorms. And we're talking about the possibility that the ancient world was deluged by floods. And, you know, there must have been some event that occurred at the end of the Ice Age when all the ice melted, number one. And number two, there is a great deal of evidence for ancient flooding, including even in this area, well, up in the Pacific Northwest, there was supposed to be a vast lake that was caused by, they had volcanic eruptions that laid out hundreds and thousands, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of square miles of lava. And so up to 100 feet thick, which is like incredible, you know. So some of the eruptions blocked up rivers and created lakes that later broke free, and the flooding was devastating. Prehistoric megastorms.
An ancient deluge, 200 times more explosive than Niagara Falls.
It's like 1,000 car crashes all at once. It's massive amounts of energy. Lots of noise.
A landmass twice the size of Ireland submerged.
This is hundreds of thousands of square kilometers of land that was replaced, reclaimed by the sea.
The foundation of civilization washed away and scattered across the globe.
This would just completely transform the world that we know.
Could the flood in the biblical story of Noah have really happened?
If that is not the material from which myths are created, I cannot imagine any other material.
And are we in danger of it happening again? Water. More than two-thirds of our planet's surface is covered by this essential element, which has sustained life since the dawn of time. But what happens when the Earth's waters turn against us? Surging rivers and rising oceans have reshaped the face of the globe since its very creation.
We need water to live, but sometimes we can't live with it. When it breaks its bounds, when rivers flood, when lakes flow, you see that thing that's usually so life-giving taking lives by the hundreds, by the thousands, sometimes by the millions.
Perhaps no storm could be more destructive than if the massive amounts of water held in the world's oceans were unleashed all at once. 6000 BC, Asia Minor, at a point where the continents of Europe and Asia meet. A narrow strip of land separating the cradle of civilization from the vast Mediterranean Sea gives way. With the power of all the world's oceans at its back, the water erupts with cataclysmic force, engulfing everything in its path. The torrent catapults into the populated valley below, towards an immense lake. The roar of this wall of water can be heard for nearly 100 miles.
The force is just incredible, and the weight of all that water is incredible pressure. It would have just gone through like a jet and would have surged through. It would have been a horrendous sight.
As the torrent erupts in the basin, lightning cracks across the sky, and a thick blanket of fog envelops the area. Water swallows the land.
This flood would have been actually raising the coastline of the sea at the rate of about half a mile a day.
The immense flood forces every living thing to flee for higher ground. But those who cannot escape are engulfed by the rising waters.
It must have been one of the most incredible sights that they've ever seen. A whole sea emptying into another sea.
For more than 100 days, the water keeps roaring in. More and more land is submerged. Eventually, the sea swallows a landmass twice the size of Ireland, more than 60,000 square miles. The deluge literally reshapes the face of the globe.
So this is hundreds of thousands of square kilometers of land that was replaced, basically reclaimed by the sea.
This immense flood may have been one of the most destructive events the world has ever seen. It created the massive body of water we know today as the Black Sea.
Now, we had heard earlier, I had that earlier clip, that there's a lot of scientific evidence that the Black Sea was a freshwater lake and then was invaded by the sea. I'll take a little break here and come back and pick up some more pieces of the story. 523-1450 to call in, 805-618-2 text. Listening to AM Las Cruces on 1450. Be right back. I found this article about the electric winds from Venus, which I'll tell you about after this. Here's a little bit more on the idea of a global flood, an ancient global flood.
You know, I come from.
Actually, let's see. Here's a little something called the Sumerian Kings List.
One of the most stunning and shocking discoveries in the records of historical archaeology is known as the Sumerian Kings. It is taught in academics that the ancient Sumerians were the first civilizations of man. But what is not commonly taught is that this ancient culture created a set of documents set in clay tablets archiving a known history of early Earth.
several prisms of clay tablets have been deciphered, revealing the secret that has shaken the foundations of our knowledge of early Earth. These clay tablets, known as the Sumerian Kings List, have been dated to 2100 before Christ, which is over 4,000 years ago. But the real shock to these treasures is not the age of the very sophisticated writing, but the content of that writing. Among other things, the King's List is a list of kings, but divided in two. There are the King's List that ruled before the global flood, and there are the King's List that ruled after the global flood. Now, this is shocking evidence of a worldwide global flood mentioned outside the biblical book of Genesis. What is more striking is that the King's List prior to the flood lived many years longer than the King's List after the global flood. This is consistent with the book of Genesis. But what is perhaps even more revealing in this way, which the Sumerian King's List describes, is the global flood of Genesis itself. It has been translated this way. Quote, after the flood swept over the earth, when the kingship again was lowered from heaven. Here it is in the Sumerian King's List, a record retrieved from the first post-flood civilization documenting the actual history that took place on Earth and backing up the Genesis record.
Kind of interesting. I don't know too much about that, but I do know that that's actually, I believe, Acadia. And according to the Bible, the founder of Acadia was Nimrod. All right, so here is a little. Let me see here. Hold on one second. All right, yeah. So here's a little bit more on the flood myth or deluge. So just think about this. There is plenty of evidence of ancient flooding in all parts of the world, China, North America, South America, Asia, Europe. There's a flood myth in every ancient, or just about every ancient, I think in every ancient culture that they've been able to find any documentation of, they have a flood myth, many of them resembling what you would encounter in the New Testament. So, I mean, where did all these myths come from? And was there one epic flood, or were there a series of floods? And what happened after the Ice Age stopped? What happened to all that water? How did the Ice Age melt anyway? Must have been global warming. And this is from Forbidden Archaeology. There was some clips that I didn't include in this. I didn't know how much time I'd have today, but there was a clip that I listened to on Easter Island, you know, the place with the giant heads that are buried. And they also have a flood myth that's kind of interesting. The clip on it was very long and didn't have a lot of detail on it.
How did we begin? Where was the origin of civilization? Experts have offered many theories based on what they observe, but do we really know? For sometimes evidence turns up which completely contradicts all theories. In the frozen earth of Siberia, remains are found of lost animal species such as the giant mammoth, wiped out by a sudden global cataclysm. Ancient maps have been discovered which show the continent of Antarctica centuries before we discovered it.
This map, which is centuries old, depicts the true configuration of Queen Maud's Land, which is now under nearly a kilometer of ice, and its true configuration wasn't determined until 1949.
A century ago, an archaeologist concluded the ancient city of Tiwanaku in Bolivia was a stellar observatory aligned to the sun and stars. From it, he calculated its age to be 17,000 years old. His evidence was ridiculed until recently.
The only correction that I would make is that we now have better astronomical measurements due to satellites and computers. And I would suspect the date would be more like 12,000 years ago. But that still makes Tiwanaku the oldest city known on the face of the earth.
Geologists found that the Great Sphinx of Egypt has been weathered by centuries of incessant heavy rain. Such rain can only have occurred thousands of years before the pharaohs. Was the Sphinx built way before the dawn of civilization?
What's at issue here is the entire history of civilization. It may not have gone in a straight line from stupid old cavemen to smart old us with our hydrogen bombs and our striped toothpaste.
Sometimes evidence is found which breaks all the rules. In this program, we'll meet people who are looking at precisely this evidence and chart new theories which may change our views on the course of human civilization.
This huge face was carved by the ancient Olmecs of Mexico. It's believed to be at least 2,000 years old. It's quite unmistakably African. Yet, Negroes are not supposed to have come to America until after the time of Columbus.
In his book, From Atlantis to the Sphinx, author Colin Wilson collects clues which he and others believe to reveal footprints of a lost, advanced civilization that existed before history began. Greek philosopher Plato described precisely such a civilization, which Egyptian priests told him sailed the oceans thousands of years earlier until it was destroyed in a huge cataclysm. He called it Atlantis. Atlantis, a huge cataclysm. We know of such a cataclysm from another myth, the biblical flood, Noah and his ark, a myth equally scorned by scientists.
Yet, when they reject the biblical deluge and Noah's ark as fable, scientists are ignoring the fact that across the entire world, there are hundreds of flood myths, quite apart from the Mesopotamian and the Hebrew accounts, which tell the same story of a worldwide disaster which virtually wiped out mankind before the beginning of recorded history. Was there really something like a flood? And if so, was there a civilization that came before all the others? I'm saying a civilization and not Atlantis, because as soon as you mention that word Atlantis, every scientist groans, oh no, and stops listening. The notion of a universal flood is beyond intellectual respectability. But how unbiased is science itself? Does it really do what it claims to do? Take the facts and start from there.
Throughout history, science has tended to focus more on its own theories than on the facts. From facts, a theory arises to explain them. Other facts are laid aside. New facts may change the theory, but as often, they're again ignored. We call such facts anomalies.
All right, so if you were to look up flood stories, there's a lot of different sites that have it. There's just hundreds in here, it looks like, from Europe, Near East, Africa, Asia, Australia. The Australian Aborigines had a lot of flood myths. North American, many of the native tribes had flood myths. Central America, South America, the world wide over. Let's take a little break here for some local news. Kelly O'Connelly, I'm Los Cruces AM 1450, 523, 1450. Be right back. All right, so we've been talking about proof of an ancient flood. Now, here is a little bit that I picked up from. All right, so this is from somebody called Robert Schock, S-C-H-O-C-H. Question is, what happened at the end of the Ice Age? What kind of flooding? Catastrophic termination of the last ice age.
The Moai, and you have all kinds of incredible mysteries there. Notice the Moai with the hands and the navel. Just as a side note, you get something very similar at Göbekli Tepe, I think. But these are some of the petroglyphs. Notice the hands. We were just hearing about the hand shape. And you have comparisons. These are just some comparisons between Easter and Petra and Göbekli Tepe. But what you have on Easter Island, which is really very strange and mysterious, is this so-called indigenous something. This is a modern reconstruction monument outside the governor's office, but the Rongo Rongo script. Have people heard about that? It's on wooden tablets, only about two dozen, 26 or so. People argue about the authenticity of some of them. Are known at this point. They're inscribed on these wooden tablets, and these have never been, to this moment, unless we're right about it, really been properly interpreted or deciphered. So we're looking at these. We've come back from Easter Island. It was sort of like a little break from thinking about other things. We're looking at it, but I can't get my mind off of it.
I think this is the one clip that I had that was a little too far afield looking. All right. So here's kind of a summary. Understand that there was an ice age. It was global in existence. And when it melted, there were floods associated with that. Now here is kind of a summary of this from a guy by the name of Ken Ham.
Australia. In my homeland of Australia, there's an indigenous people called the Australian Aborigines. Now, there were people that lived with the Australian Aborigines for years before they ever met missionaries who wrote down their legends. And many of those legends are in books in museums in Australia today. But some of those legends actually sound like the Bible, particularly the account of the flood in the Bible. There are legends they have about three sons on a boat to survive the flood, and then the boat landed on a mountain and God put a rainbow in the sky to tell them what the weather would be like. They have stories about this man who was told to build a raft and take the cockatoo and kangaroo because there's a global flood coming. And so it goes on. In fact, they have other stories too that sound like accounts in Genesis, such as woman made while man was asleep, or forbidden tree, and so on. You know, it's not just the Australian Aborigines, the American Indians, the Fijians, the Hawaiians, Eskimos, and so on, back to the Babylonians, all have stories that sound like Genesis 1-11 in the Bible, and they have these flood legends. The interesting thing is they have elements that are all similar to the Bible. There's lots of differences, but there are lots of similar elements too in regard to animals being taken on a boat, there being global flood, there being three sons or one man that built the boat, and so on. Now, why is this so? Well, I believe it is evidence that there was a real flood and that the record of the actual flood is right there in the Bible. In fact, in the Bible, in Genesis, we read about a man called Noah who was told to build a big ark, a big boat, and take on it each kind of land animal to survive a global flood. Now, if there really was a global flood, what would you expect to find? Well, think about it. If there was a global flood, we'd expect to find billions of dead things buried in rough layers, laid down by water all over the earth. And what do we find? Actually, we find billions of dead things buried in rough layers, laid down by water all over the earth. Now, of course, those who believe in evolution and don't believe the Bible is true say that the fossil record was laid down over millions of years, and they say that, you know, the older layers are on the bottom and the youngest layers are on the top. Actually, I also believe the oldest layers are on the bottom, by and large, and the youngest layers are on the top, but younger by maybe a few months, not millions of years, as we're told by the evolutionists today. In fact, when you dig up the fossils, they don't have labels on them. When you go and look at those layers with the fossils in them, they don't have little labels saying, hi, I was laid down millions of years ago. You see, the layers and the fossils exist in the present. And what we need to do is try to understand what happened in the past with the present here. But the more you look at the fossil record, the more you look at those sedimentary layers, the more it speaks of catastrophism, in fact, massive catastrophism. In fact, to make a fossil is a catastrophic event. Think about it. If an animal dies, it basically rots. If a deer dies out in the woods, other animals come and eat it, it rots, it doesn't turn into a fossil. How do you make something into a fossil? You have to cover it very quickly. But there are billions of fossils all over the earth and layers of rock sometimes miles deep. It required a massive amount of mud, a massive amount of water. Actually, we believe it's the record of a flood as recorded in the Bible, that there really was such a flood. In fact, you can see other evidence that's totally consistent with this, confirming the Bible's account of the flood. When you go to the Grand Canyon, I stood on the edge of the Grand Canyon with an evolutionist, and there we are looking a mile deep down to the canyon and 10 to 12 miles across this massive canyon, looking at all those layers that make up the sides of the canyon. And the evolutionist said to me, a long time and a little bit of water did this. And I stood there and said, actually, there's a lot of water and a little bit of time that did this. And you know, actually, the evidence at the Grand Canyon confirms it was made under catastrophic conditions. Behind the Grand Canyon, there's evidence there were great big lakes. In fact, that whole area was raised up. It's called the Kaibab Plateau. Now, the Bible indicates how God ended the flood. He raised up the land and sank the ocean basin, and the water poured off into the ocean basin. Actually, Psalm 104 seems to indicate that. Now, if there really was a global flood, and God ended the flood by raising up the mountains and then sinking the ocean basins, then you expect to see evidence consistent with that, and you do. When you go.
All right, so that's interesting. That would, in terms of the fossil evidence, is to make a fossil. There were some scientists that did, or to petrify something. There were some Japanese scientists, maybe 10 years ago, that had. There was Japan is very volcanic. There was a new eruption, and there was formed a volcanic lake, and then they went up and pulled some stuff out of the lake, a brand new lake, and tested it and found that it was starting to petrify, the wood that was floating in this. And so they put a piece of wood under a volcanic lake. They put it under the waterfall that was coming out of it, came back and tested it, I think, 9 months later, and found out that within 40 years it would be petrified. For something to become petrified, it needs to be immersed in mud or water, something like that. The water has to be acidic, and it needs to have silicate in it or dissolved sand. So flooding itself doesn't, or fossils themselves don't prove any ancient time frame. Fossilization can happen rather quickly. So another proof of a worldwide flood would be a lot of fossils. So anyway, 523-1450-805-6180. We'll come right back, and I'll tell you about this story about the electric winds on Venus. I guess this is kind of ended up being a science show. Okay, so let's get in here for a little bit from Venus. The electric wind may strip the planet of its oceans.
So Venus is cool. Venus is awesome. Venus is, in many ways, one of the most Earth-like planets that we know of. One of the key ways that it's different is that it's very, very dry. Never expect there to be liquid oceans on the surface. That kind of temperature only boils off that water into steam, but the atmosphere of Venus is still incredibly dry. So where did the steam go? The force of gravity. So the gravity is the thing which is holding you down to the planet. But if you think about it, it's also what is holding the atmosphere down onto the planet as well. Venus's electric field is at least 5 to 10 times stronger than at Earth. It's a monster of a force. It can rip heavy things like oxygen straight out of the upper atmosphere and send them kicking and screaming off into space. And for exoplanets, for habitable planets around other stars, it is no good having conditions perfect for an ocean and an atmosphere that you might want to breathe if some invisible force is going to come along and rip it all off into space.
I guess that's true. Here's a little bit more on the electric winds of Venus from Glenn Collison of NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center.
I'm Glenn Collison from NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, and I'm here to tell you today about the electric wind of Venus. So Venus is cool. Venus is awesome. Venus is, in many ways, one of the most Earth-like planets that we know of. One of the key ways that it's different is that it's very, very dry. With temperatures on the surface of 460 degrees centigrade, whatever that is in Fahrenheit, you would never expect there to be liquid oceans on the surface. That kind of temperature only boils off that water into steam, but the atmosphere of Venus is still incredibly dry. So where did the steam go? So to talk about how we remove something from a planet, we're going to have to talk about two forces of nature. Firstly, the force of gravity. Gravity is the thing which is holding you down to the planet. But if you think about it, it's also what is holding the atmosphere down onto the planet as well. If I want to remove some of the oxygen from the planet, we have to overcome that gravity. So to do that, I want to talk about the electric force. It's the thing which your device is using right now to pump electricity around its wires, right? It's pushing the electrons around the circuit. And what we think can happen is that the electric force can help push on the ions and in the upper parts of the atmosphere, push them off and up into space. So just as every planet has a gravity field, we think that every planet has a weak electric field. So we went looking for Venus's electric field, and boy oh boy did we find it. It turns out that Venus's electric field is at least 5 to 10 times stronger than at Earth. It's a monster of a force. It can rip heavy things like oxygen straight out of the upper atmosphere and send them kicking and screaming off into space. So this really changes the way we have to think about planets, because it turns out that planets can lose heavy things like oxygen to space entirely through electrical forces in their ionospheres. This is something that's really important if we want to go looking for exoplanets, for habitable planets around other stars. It is no good having conditions perfect for an ocean and an atmosphere that you might want to breathe if some invisible force is going to come along and rip it all off into space. Only understanding how atmospheres evolve can we try and understand how we got here.
All right, that's the Venus story. So anyway, so they want us to live in these stupid balloons, dirigibles above this very toxic surface. But anyway, so I don't know where they think we're going to live, but it all buys into the story of this idea that we've got global warming and the Earth is being destroyed and everything, which is just gets so stale to hear. I mean, there's never any genuine proof. All of the proof that comes out of this has to do with they have a model, they come up with a computer model. The computer model doesn't have any ability to recreate reality. And a lot of times they tweak it to make sure there's a catastrophe. It's all ridiculous, but anyway, just my opinion of it, of course. All right. So I've got a clip from Rex Tillerson talking about the goals of the U.S. in Syria. And I thought it was good. This guy has a lot of global experience, and here he is.
The first chemical attack launched by Assad. In fact, there were two other chemical attacks the week of March 25th and the 30th. And there have been chemical weapons attacks made by the Bashar al-Assad regime in the past. So this was just the latest of a series of violations.
But right now, the Syrian people have no way to remove Assad. That's going to take greater pressure from the United States, from international coalition, perhaps military pressure.
Well, ultimately it could, George, but you know, we've seen what that looks like when you undertake a violent regime change in Libya. And the situation in Libya continues to be very chaotic, and I would argue that the life of the Libyan people is not all that well off today. So I think we have to learn the lessons of the past and learn the lessons of what went wrong in Libya when you choose that pathway of regime change. So we know this is going to be hard work, but we think it's also a process that will lead to a durable and lasting stability inside of Syria. Anytime you go in and have a violent change at the top, it is very difficult to create the conditions for stability longer term.
So it sounds like from what you're saying right now, there is no real change in the United States military stance towards Syria from what it was last week.
That's correct, George. This strike, I think the president was very clear in his message to the American people that this strike was related solely to the most recent horrific use of chemical weapons against women, children, and as the president said, even small babies. And so the strike was a message to Bashar al-Assad that your multiple violations of your agreements at the UN, your agreements under the chemical weapons charter back in 2013, that those would not go without a response in the future. And we are asking Russia to fulfill its commitment, and we're asking and calling on Bashar al-Assad to cease the use of these weapons. Other than that, there is no change to our military posture.
You mentioned earlier, you mentioned the Russian.
All right, so there you go. And we'll take one last break. 752, Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1455, 23, 1450 to call in 805-618-0 to text. Did you know that French fries are more of a superfood than kale? Don't be fooled, friends. Kale is disgusting. All right, so here's a little something called This Old Toaster from a comedian called Josh Sneed. Here we go.
Town you folks live in. There's crazy people nearby, and if you ever want to meet them, like just see what they're like, it's actually pretty simple. Have a garage sale. That's all you do. Put it in the newspaper and or on Craigslist that you're having a garage sale, and a freak show will form on your lawn 2 hours before the garage sale is scheduled to begin. I was looking out the blinds. I was like, we said 8, right? Well, they're here. It would look like The Walking Dead out there. They're just like, deals, bargains. It's kind of fun, you know? You've got this little human fish bowl right there. See them interact with each other. But then you got to kick them out because they won't leave. It's like, I don't know if you guys are waiting for us to open another wing. Like, this is all that's left. If you could please make your purchases and go, the garage door will be closing in 10 minutes. But they won't leave because they're afraid that they missed something. They sat at home watching American Pickers and Storage Wars and Pawn Stars and Antique Roadshow, and they're convinced that there is treasure to be found somewhere in my garage. It's annoying. Stand around in my garage. This one guy was like, sir, can I help you with something? He's like, you got any antiques? No, I'm sorry, we don't have any antiques. But we do have some deals here. This toaster, did you see this over here? We got married last year. We didn't need two toasters. So we're going to sell this one, and it's $1. And they will talk you down. It doesn't matter how good your prices are. These shows are teaching him to argue with you for a better deal. So now he's sweating over my toaster for half an hour. Oh, buddy, I don't know. No, I think I'm good. Well, you know what? Because, like, I need a toaster, you know, and that's a Sunbeam. You know, nice. It ain't a KitchenAid or a Hamilton Beach. It certainly ain't an Oster with the 4-foot power cord. You got the standard 2-foot. I don't even know if that's going to work out or not. But you said a dollar? Yeah, no. That ain't going to happen. You know, if my wife was here, I'd know what to do right away. How's the springs? Oh, they're good. They're all right. Judging by the crumbs, looks like someone in this house is a big fan of pumpernickel. Yeah, these are good for that bread. Tell you what, buddy. I could probably go 25 cents. I'm sorry, 25 cents? How about I beat it over your face for free? How about that, dude? Because watching you leave with a broken nose would be worth way more than a dollar at this point. It's a dollar, sir. It's a toaster that still works for a dollar. No, screw this guy, honey. I got thrown out of my... Basically is what happened. Not a lot of things more humbling.